Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So, stay tuned for tonight's special report on quantitative easing when we come back. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values. These two programs encompass the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's a foreign and alien ideology. Our traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. These foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. You know, we covet our neighbor's property and we call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures called Federal Reserve notes. We practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods called government. And we're not getting away with these crimes either. You're paying up to 74% of everything that you create and produce in taxes. And we live in mortgaged homes owned by the savings and loan companies. We drive cars that are owned by GMAC or Ford Motor Finance, and the average family of four has a $70,000 consumer debt. We owe $14 trillion in national debt. We're surety for another $100 trillion of unfunded government obligations, and our financial institutions are leveraged out to a quadrillion dollars in debt structuring around the world, and our Social Security retirement system is a chain letter Ponzi scheme, and we're living from paycheck to paycheck, and then we're taught to call all of this prosperity. Well, you know, the God of Israel gave us a better way than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life, why don't you call and order our free 4-hour compact disc package? It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. Then click on to the archives. Hey, we've been talking about quantitative easing, and there's a story here by Joel Skousen in his newsletter, World Affairs Brief, entitled Hyperinflation, What It Takes to Get There. Now, in Brazil, back in the 70s, it took just 5 days to hit hyperinflation. 5 days. Now, here in the United States, this isn't a five-day program. We've been at this now for many years, and in the concluding program tomorrow, I'm going to bring you a story here that started back in the Reagan administration, which deals with hyperinflation. And they told us back then, if we don't change our ways and get our financial affairs in order, this thing's going to lead to hyperinflation. Well, okay, well, we didn't change our ways, and now we're at the point where hyperinflation is here. Just a cause and effect relationship. Now, I pointed out already, our leaders in government, in Congress, the President of the United States, the head of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, they have already set the course. Hyperinflation is the end result. That's where we're going. What we don't know is that going to take off this year, next year, the year after. I don't know. I'm not a prophet. I can't tell you, but it's coming. So get ready for it. And that's what we're talking about now, this week. Let's start thinking about hyperinflation, because that's what everybody is doing. That's the policy that we're following. Now, in the World Affairs brief, I don't have an address here. He doesn't have that here on the paper itself. It's Joel, J-O-E-L, M. Skousen, S-K-O-U-S-E-N. He's out in some little town south of Salt Lake City. I think it's in Orem, Utah. It's either Orem or Provo, Utah. And he writes a pretty good newsletter. He's a conservative. His daddy and granddaddy were agents of the FBI. He was a major, I think it was in the Marines. I think he's a Marine pilot. He's got good credentials. He's got good conservative credentials. He's a, you know, he's a patriot. And he recognizes, I think, like I do and many of the rest of us, that the salvation of America is no longer on the table. That isn't going to happen. We're going into national captivity. The economy is on the verge of collapse. I think that this is the prelude to the new One World Order program. And I'm of the opinion that we may be entering into the final phase approaching the Second Coming, called the Great Tribulation here, in about 30 prophecies here in Scripture. So in talking about hyperinflation over here, which is the last step in national economic collapse, it's the final culmination. You do everything you can to avoid it and to keep things going, and my God, they're doing everything they can to keep things cooking. But these heroic attempts, it's like trying to bail water out of the Titanic. Every bucket of water that you dump over the side from inside the ship is a step in the right direction, and I wouldn't deny that. But in the final analysis, it'll always be too little, too late. It won't solve the inevitable problem of the ship sinking. It might keep it afloat for another 10 or 15 minutes, and that could be beneficial. I wouldn't deny it. But it isn't going to stop the inevitable. And that's where we're all located today. We are all facing the inevitable. And the news media and the president and the politicians are putting the best face they can put on it. We're facing a calamity, and they're putting their best face forward and saying, I see green shoots out here, and we're going to work hard to avoid the double-dip recession. So in the last program I showed you, we're already in the double-dip recession, and by the time you recognize that, it's going to be April of 2011. So now let's recognize it right now, because that's where we're at, and then let's use the next 6 months to prepare for it. Because by the time this double dip is announced about next April, you know, which will be right after the Passover, which is when all the bad news occurs in April, then we'll find that that's about the time that we'll start seeing hyperinflation and rationing. You got to have rationing now, because there's going to be no goods on the shelf, and the Chinese aren't going to ship to us because we haven't paid our bill. And I'm not sure if the Japanese are going to ship to us. Now, when everybody else is up against it, you know, in Haiti or Chile or in Pakistan, it's the Americans that are there to help bail their chestnuts out of the fire. When we go into a catastrophe, there isn't going to be anybody there to help us. None. Name one. Just name one country you think is going to be there that's going to help Americans. Now, hyperinflation, what it takes to get there. Here's Joel Skousen's take on it. He said, I'm not optimistic about where this country is heading. But to properly confront what's coming, it's very important to understand the real risks facing us and not get misled by hype. I'm getting increasingly irritated by conservative pundits claiming that hyperinflation is imminent and just around the corner. Because it's not, and here's why. Simply put, we do not have the automatic direct injection structures in place for government to deliver those ever-increasing quantities of money directly into the hands of consumers, as they did in the Weimar Republic in Germany. Now, that doesn't mean it can't still happen. but the process currently in place works more slowly. We need to understand the process in order to correctly foresee when this threat is really upon us. This week, I will dig into this and other intricacies of hyperinflation. Now, the name that's being applied, remember, by our government is called quantitative easing. And as I showed you in the last newsletter here from the privateer, these terms, these lies, called terminological inexactitude, is merely a matter of the number of syllables employed for deception. Nothing more, nothing less. And Brian Williams, Katie Couric, and Diane Sawyer are the chief of the deceivers. They're out there in the forefront every night on the 6 o'clock news deceiving us. Let's wake up and let's get behind the scenes here. Go do a Google search on this guy, Joel Skousen, and I think you can find the World Affairs Brief. Then write to him. I don't know what the price is. It comes in here from some listener somewhere. He goes on, he says, first, let me set the stage by quoting one of the typical hyperinflation projections. Note that all of the basic data is correct. Only the leap to hyperinflation is unsupported. Here's Charles Scaliger of the New American Magazine. My comments are in brackets. Now, Charles Scaliger, in making the case for hyperinflation, says this. He says, think you're scared enough about the economy, the ballooning deficit, and the prospect of ruinous tax rates and runaway inflation to pay for astronomical government debts. If you haven't read Boston University economist Lawrence Kitlikoff's August 10th article for Bloomberg, U.S. is bankrupt and we don't even know it. You probably aren't. Dismissing official federal debt figures out of hand as misleading fiscal labeling, Kotlikoff estimates that our true fiscal gap is a staggering $202 trillion. That's about 15 times the official debt level pronounced by government statisticians. I want to pause here and make an observation. I don't know what the total obligations of government are. I hear numbers like $14 trillion at the official national debt. Then we have unfunded liabilities from Medicare and Social Security, veterans benefits, and two unfunded wars that total $100 trillion. Now, I can't personally testify to that because I can't count that high. But those are the numbers that I see coming across my desk. These unfunded liabilities now are Medicare, Social Security, medical benefits for veterans, and two unfunded wars total $100 trillion in addition to that $14 trillion national debt. That takes us up over about $114 trillion. Now, there's more than that, but we don't know how much more because I haven't seen those numbers, and this is a shocking number. This guy says $202 trillion. That's about $100 trillion more than anything I've seen or heard of or know about. I don't know if it's true or false. I don't know if it's got any basis in fact or not. Now, the $100 trillion number has a lot of basis in fact. In fact, if you take a look at what we have just done, $28.1 trillion worth of additional debt assumption by our government, that might be heading up toward that $202 trillion mark. I can't tell you yes or no, but it could be. Those are astronomical numbers. It dwarfs anything that the Greeks, the pigs countries, you know, Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, and Ireland. I mean, all of those guys combined don't owe anywhere near that. I mean, the Greeks, you know, they don't even owe $1 trillion. I think now with their bailout program, they might owe 400 billion, you know, 4/10 of a trillion. They'll never be able to pay back that $400 billion. But nevertheless, the Greek debt structure is much better than America's. I mean, if you were to compare them, oranges and oranges and apples and apples, what's happening here in America, see, we're not plugging in AIG, the bank bailouts, Social Security, Medicare, veterans benefits. We're not plugging any of that in to our debt structure. All we're claiming is that we get a $14 trillion national debt, which is just the tip of the iceberg. Now, going on here, he says, the reason for this vast discrepancy is the scurrilous practice used by the federal government to conceal the real levels of indebtedness, of declaring certain liabilities like Social Security and Medicare payouts as off budget. It's as though these are not enormous sums of money that the federal government has committed to pay over the next couple of decades as waves of baby boomers and Generation Xers retire. Now, the federal government has behaved like an imprudent householder who, having taken out a mortgage, a car loan, and a student loan, then proceeds to run up an enormous credit card debt, then declares the credit card debt to be off budget, and then totally ignores it. Well, just as the laws, credit ratings, and debt collectors will eventually catch up with such behavior in the private sector, so too the pitiless laws of economics will eventually bring our federal government to heel. This is unsustainable, and there comes a point in time, just like with the Greeks and the pigs countries and so on, when this is going to come back and bite us all in the butt. Now, the day of reckoning won't be pleasant, and Katlikoff minces no words in describing an outcome comparable to that of the Weimar Republic and what they endured in the great hyperinflation of the 1920s. Herb Stein, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under U.S. President Richard Nixon, coined an oft-repeated phrase. He said, "Something that can't go on will stop." And that's true enough. Uncle Sam's Ponzi scheme will stop, but it will stop too late. And it will stop in a very nasty manner. The first possibility is massive benefit cuts visited on the baby boomers in retirement. Skousen says that won't happen because the politicians have to pander to the voters to get reelected. So they're not going to cut your benefits on Social Security, rest assured. The second is astronomical tax increases that leave the young with little incentive to work and save. Skousen in bracket says that too is political suicide unless you only tax the rich. So you can rest assured they're not going to raise your taxes. So without tax increases and without benefit cuts, then there's only one other solution, isn't there? Watch this. And the third is for the government to simply start printing vast quantities of money to cover its bills. And, Skousen points out in brackets here, he says, and they don't actually have to print money to create more. Electronic creation is the modern way. So they don't have to print anymore. They'll just do it by computer. And then the bond traders will kick us miles down our road once they wake up and realize that the U.S. is in worse financial shape than Greece. And Skousen says in brackets here, actually bonds are probably the first to realize when the government starts to inflate its way out of debt and it destroys their market, which dwarfs stocks. So all the stock markets in this country are dwarfed by the bond market. So tuck that one away in your heart. So if you're holding bonds, these could be Los Angeles municipal bonds or state of California state bonds or United States Treasury bonds, they're all going to collapse. And you will collect something for them, maybe 10 cents on the dollar, you know, there'll be something, with more paper. In other words, you will be paid more worthless paper for the worthless paper that you're being paid for out of more worthless paper. Can you follow that? Okay. So, and that worthless paper will buy something at Walmart, but we don't know what's going to be on the shelves. It may be down to hominy and jalapeno peppers. Now, he goes on to say simply put, the lies that our government continues to tell itself and us about the debts run up over the past few decades will soon be laid bare. What Katlikoff has labeled Enron accounting, I think I'll underline that one. Enron accounting, that's a good term. has enabled the federal government to perpetuate the deception whereby older generations are subsidized by younger generations. Few Americans are even aware that the so-called Social Security Trust Fund consists only of IOUs, which is the same with the FDIC guarantee of your bank deposits. All they've got there is IOUs. There's no money there. The federal government spends Social Security contributions before they're even paid, just as it spends every last cent of money extracted from the collective taxpayer's hide. Government neither saves nor invests. Government only consumes. And the government is going to continue to consume and consume and consume. And there's three entities here that work in tandem. It's the government, the banks, and the multinational corporations. Those three entities are going to consume off of us until there is nothing left to consume. So a long time before your three beasts here, the government, the corporations, and the banks, take everything you've got, you better take a little bit of what you've got and squirrel it away for yourself. And the way to do that is to physically put away the gold and silver coin, or, better yet, the wheat, corn, beans, honey, oil, and clothes that you're going to need over the next 4 or 5 years. You need to have the physical goods on your shelf. If the physical goods are on the Walmart shelf, you may or may not get any of those, depending upon how many people get there to the store before you do. Remember this. Here's a kicker. If you take all the money in circulation here in the United States, and if everybody took their money and went down and converted it today into wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, everybody equally would get 2% or 2 cents on the dollar. So 98 cents worth of your purchasing power is not physically there. We're leveraged out that far, 50 to 1. 50 to 1, that's what the leverage is. So as long as all of us hang on to our money and we only go down to the store and buy 1 or 2% per week, we're all right. It's okay. But then when the squeeze comes and the 1 or 2% is no longer satisfactory and we start taking 3%, shortages will start coming. Now when these shortages show up, it causes people to hit the panic switch. Then they run out and they buy everything in sight. And boy, that's going to bring disaster, because as soon as they start buying everything in sight, then you've got massive shortages. That's where everybody hits the panic switch. Now government comes in with wage and price controls and rationing, which is inevitably coming. That's what always happens with these hyperinflations. So tuck it away in your heart. Now, one unpleasant point that Kotlikoff avoids is that there is a difference between tax rates and tax revenues. Simply put, Americans will be neither able nor willing to pay significantly higher taxes. Demands to pay higher income taxes will most likely be met with either non-payment or outright revolt, which will leave the federal government only the option of printing its way out of debt. And once the rest of the world figures out that game, though the feds will find no takers for their bonds, and the end of America as we know it will come about as a tsunami of hyperinflation. Now, the vehicle for doing this will be fairly simple and straightforward. Skousen points out, he says, there's no methodology or no modality in place today. Well, yeah, there is. You see, you got 50 million people now, or pushing on to that, somewhere around that are on Social Security. What the government will do is say, well, because of inflation, what we're going to do is we're going to boost your check. And so they'll say, well, we're going to give you double the amount of money. Then you'll have twice as much money. Now let's take all these state governments. The state governments that can't meet their obligations, can't pay their bonds, can't pay their employees, the federal government will just print the money and send it to California. California will then go out into the marketplace and just spend the money and pay everybody. But there's no corresponding jars of mayonnaise, mustard, and ketchup on the shelves, which now will cause shortages. And it's exacerbated by the higher and higher rates of unemployment, because these unemployed people are producing nothing, but they're still consuming mayonnaise, mustard, and ketchup. So they're consuming but not producing. And then the teachers, the firemen, these are called the first responders, you know, the policemen, firemen, the teachers, and all these people, ambulance drivers and so on. These people have to be kept on the job, and so the federal government will use the state government as the vehicle to pass these out. And so state governments will simply pass out paychecks to the teachers, the firemen, the policemen, the army, all you army guys, you're all going to get paid. And the government will come in and take the mayonnaise, mustard, and ketchup to feed the soldiers, policemen, firemen, teachers, government workers, before any of the people out here on Main Street, you know, the mechanics and the rest of the little guys down here, all the people that are out here working, the working people, manufacturing, you know, and the workmen that work in the automobile factories. And that's why we have to have this rationing system. So be prepared for that. Now, for that to be true, it requires a detailed analysis of how hyperinflation occurred in Germany in 1923 and 24. And remember, when this hyperinflation comes, the maximum length of time is 18 months. So hyperinflation does not go on forever and ever. You know, it only goes on for a period of 18 months. In most cases, it'll run its course in anywhere from 6 months to 9 months. About half that 18 months, about 6 to 9 months. And that's because the money becomes absolutely valueless. Now, in some cases, it may run longer than that. But as a general rule, the hyperinflation that we saw in Hungary, Romania, China, and Germany, they were fairly short-lived, 18 months or less. There may be some examples where it went on for something longer than that. But as a general rule, we're going to have a new colored money. Now, when the new colored money comes out, it's irrelevant to those of us that deal in property, because we're not going to deal in the dollars of today, and we're not going to deal in the dollars of tomorrow. We're going to deal in the property of today and the property of tomorrow. Big difference. See, private business deals in property. Public business deals in trade, commerce, business, and industry, which affects a public interest. That's called commerce. That's what we're prohibited from doing in the scripture. You know, we were told not to participate in this Canaanite trafficking, and that's exactly what we went into and did. And, of course, now it's coming back and biting us in the butt. All right, so going on, he said, now why did the German government not act to halt the inflation? It was a shaky, fragile government to start with, especially after the assassination of Walter Rathenau, the SPD foreign minister that was killed in 1922. So in January of 1923, Germany failed to make a payment, and France invaded the Ruhr Valley. And the vengeful French sent their army into the Ruhr Valley to enforce their demands for repatriation, or reparations, rather, from the Versailles Treaty from World War I. And the Germans were powerless to resist. So more than inflation, the Germans feared unemployment. So in 1919, communists had tried to take over the government, and severe unemployment might give the communists another chance. The great German industrial combines of Krupp, Thyssen, Farben, and Steins condoned the inflation and survived it well. A cheaper mark, they reasoned, would make German goods cheap and easy to export, and they needed the export earnings to buy raw materials abroad so that they could continue the manufacturing, so that they could make their reparations payments. They were on a merry-go-round. Well, inflation kept everyone working as the pace of the economy and the velocity of money, that is, the circulation of money, kept accelerating. So the cost of living index was 41 in June 1922. It was 685 in December. That's an increase of more than 16 times. The occupation of the industrial region of Germany in the Ruhr Valley took place to ensure that the reparations were paid in goods, such as coal and steel. The mark was viewed as practically worthless. Now, here is one key, then. Inflation was exacerbated when workers in the Ruhr went on strike, and the German government printed more money in order to continue paying them for passively resisting. So, Skousen points out that that was the first structural step that allowed the German government to start injecting currency directly into the hands of citizens, which allows for a rapid expansion of the money supply in ever-increasing quantities. So in order for hyperinflation to take off, there has to be a mechanism in place for government to inject this printed currency, this new money, directly into the hands of consumers. And so the best way for them to do that today is with the school teachers, policemen, firemen, government workers in general, and directly through all of the retirement benefits. You know, all of these retirement plans that you people are reading about that are underfunded. Okay. Well, government will come right in there and fund those. Just come right in there. They'll take that California CalPERS over there and they'll just put the money in there and fund it. And then the CalPERS people can just write up the checks and send it out to all of you recipients, all of you people that are retired. And then you'll go out and you'll spend that money at Walmart and take all the goods off the shelves. And then when the goods are taken off the shelves, you know, the question arises, well, are the Chinese going to keep shipping those shoes and big screen TVs and stuff to us? I don't believe it, but we'll wait and see, won't we? Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. Go to the archives page. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, do not mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about quantitative easing from the newsletter by Joel Skousen. He puts this out weekly. It's a weekly newsletter. And it usually runs about six, seven, 8 pages. It's it depends every week. Now, the International Forecaster, remember, the internationalforecaster.com, it comes out once a week. No, in fact, it's worse than that. It's twice a week. Twice a week. Bob Chapman puts out that paper twice a week. That's a monstrous newsletter. I recommend the International Forecaster probably number one, simply because he's not that difficult to understand. It is true, it's more difficult, but, you know, as you get into it a little bit, you'll be able to pick up on these acronyms. But he has political, economic comment. He just kind of stands head and shoulders above everybody else, maybe by the sheer volume of material that he puts out. I'm not quite sure. His newsletter, I think, is $160 a year. You can find him at theinternationalforecaster.com. And remember, the privateer, you'll find him at the-privateer.com. And goldenjackass.com, that one's self-explanatory, just goldenjackass.com. You're looking for Jim Willie there. And now we're taking a look here at Joel Skousen, and about, you know, twice, three, four times a year, I pick up these newsletters and do a current events report, and I give you, well, here's what's going on in the economic scene, or on the economic scene. And now the news is out, and this is the purpose for this week's program. It's quantitative easing, which is a euphemism for hyperinflation. That's where we're headed. And all of the newsletters are telling you the same story. Now, it isn't going to happen tomorrow morning. So that gives you a little bit of time. But it is coming. It is going to happen. And when it does, you're all going to be surprised. And you'll say, I never thought of that. I never would have thought of that. Okay. And so that's why I told you Jim Willie here on his archives goes back to 2005. I pulled two more off. And what he was saying back in 2005 is now in your news every day. And what these newsletter writers are telling us today is what you're going to be hearing about from Katie, Brian, and Diane about 6 months from now. Now, it's not because these people are clairvoyant or that they're tuned in to Satan or God or anybody else. It's just common sense. Just dealing with reality. You pay attention to these buzzwords like quantitative easing. That's inflation. God, I like this one over here from Bill Buckler. Listen to this. Price stability, when you hear that word, that means price fixing. And when you hear troubled asset relief program, that means bailing out the banks. When you hear of quantitative easing, that means printing money. All right, now that's what these underground newsletters are so good at. It's taken the hyperbole off of the BS and getting down to the bottom line that truck drivers and housewives and beer drinkers like you and me can understand so that we can do something intelligent for ourselves. Because if you think the Democrats, the Republicans, or the banks are going to do anything for you, you got your head right up your derriere, Bobby. Now let's wake up. Now, going on here, it says inflation kept everyone working as the pace of the economy, that is, the velocity and monetary circulation, kept accelerating. The cost of living index was 41 in June of 1922. It rose to 685 in December of 1922, an increase of more than 16 times. All right, that's the classic definition of hyperinflation. When prices double every year, that's not quite hyperinflation yet. That's heavy-duty inflation, but that ain't hyper. When prices are doubling every month, now you're at hyperinflation levels. That's where we're headed. And you people that are business people, you know, small stores and so on, let me pass a little piece of information off. Go to the Money Changer. That's Franklin Sanders. He wrote an article here some months back, maybe a year ago or so, on how small business can survive in hyperinflation. Now, I've never gone through hyperinflation. I don't know how to do that. I read the article. I was pretty impressed. Why don't you call Franklin Sanders and see if Franklin Sanders, that's the moneychanger.com. Well, I'm going to say moneychanger.com. Let me see if that's really true. Looking here at the Money Changer. I don't know if he's got a web page or not. You know that? Well, Frank, he might be like me. He might not have a web page. Oh yeah, here we go. You can get him at, yeah, there it is right there. www.the-moneychanger.com. God love him, he's on the internet. There you are. www.the-moneychanger.com. You're looking at Franklin at the-moneychanger.com if you want to email him. If you want to call him, why don't you call him at 888, toll free, 888-218-9226. 888-218-9226. Now, the thing that's good about Franklin Sanders over here, he puts out a paper. It's put out once a month, a little tabloid paper. And he's into politics. He's into gold and silver, hot and heavy. And he's always got a good article in there every month, a good article. And this one I'm telling you about is it dealt with hyperinflation, how small business deals with hyperinflation. Hell, it was a dynamite article. Hell of a good story. And I would suggest you get in touch with him because you're going to have a hard time. When hyperinflation sets in, it's going to bankrupt you. Unless you're on top of it and you take action, you're probably not going to survive it. All right, so now with that out of the way, let me go on. So the printing presses ran. This is in Germany now. The printing presses are running. And once those printing presses began to run, they were hard to stop. The price increases began to be dizzying. The menus in cafes could not be revised quickly enough. A student at Freiburg University ordered a cup of coffee at a cafe, and the price on the menu was 5,000 marks. He had two cups. When the bill came, the bill was 14,000 marks. So if you want to save money, he was told, if you want to save money, and you want two cups of coffee, you should order them both at the same time. And by late 1923, the German government required 1,783 printing presses running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just to print the money. And in November of 1924, the value of the paper money exceeded the BTU output that money could buy in firewood. It was cheaper for you to burn the money than it was to buy the firewood to burn. How do you like that? Now, that came to an end when everybody is ruined and everybody's wiped out. All of you Social Security people will be wiped out. Just no more pension. I don't know what the hell an 85-year-old widow lady is going to do with no pension when this thing runs its course. I don't have a clue as to what you're going to do, lady, but get ready for it because here it comes. And you people that are thinking about retirement right now, I hear people, you know, they're like, hey, I'm getting ready to retire in a couple of years. Boy, if I were you, I wouldn't retire. I'd stay right there on that job as long as I could. Another year or two might help you quite a bit. You know, think about it. Now, the payment of resistance money to the workers in the Ruhr was not sufficient to an oven by itself to cause hyperinflation. Germany was also forced to pay for war victim pensions and compensation for their families. This broadened the flow to a majority of all Germans. So with over half the citizens having access to an ever-increasing flow of income, the rest of the country began to respond in kind and to demand increased wages. Businessmen started raising prices regularly to pay for their increasing labor and material costs, and the process started to gallop away. Now, this is a process that develops, but the mechanics for doing that are already in place. The federal government can simply pass the money on to you Social Security recipients, all of you government retirees, and all of the government employees. And the federal government, of course, will continue paying the big corporations and the mega banks. And then they will go out here to the states and they will assume all of their debts and obligations to keep them functioning. And then that money will be pumped into the economy, and all those people will have money to put into the economy to bid prices up and take the goods off the shelf and so on. And the thing is underway. And Ben Bernanke says that's what we're going to do. And I believe Ben telling us what he's going to do. And that's exactly what we've seen going on for the last 2 years, and I don't see any reason for them to stop. If they do, then we have a deflationary depression. And everybody says that's what they don't want. I'm the only guy around here telling you, hey, boys and girls, if you got a choice and you got a whipping coming, take the whipping with your pants up. Now, I guess you can take your whipping tomorrow with your pants down, but I would suggest you take your whipping right now with your pants up. I tested that. Let me tell you, that belt on your bare skin is going to hurt like hell. That hyperinflation now, it's going to come later, but it's going to hurt a lot worse than deflation. Now, that's what I read, that's what I see, that's what I hear, that's what I'm concerned about. But that isn't going to be the reality of it. The reality is going to be hyperinflation. Boys and girls, get ready for it. You know, that's the message from this week. Get ready for it. Now, here's the history of the modern world. Pointed out that the only ones destroyed initially were those on fixed incomes. People with annuities, pensions, proceeds of insurance policies, savings accounts in the banks, income from bonds and mortgages. Every form of revenue which had been arranged for at some time in the past, and which often represented the economy, foresight, and personal planning of many years, now turned to nothing. The middle class was pauperized and demoralized. Eventually, everyone was hurt, but in particular, that middle class. And all of you people that are on pensions, people that are on welfare and food stamps and so on down the line, you people are going to be abandoned, just dumped. You need to start taking action right now. The poorest. Now, what's going to happen here when crisis comes, the army has to come out to keep order because you people are going to get rowdy. Now, when people are getting rowdy and they're breaking windows out of the banks, this is what happened down in Argentina. Do you remember that? The people got out on the streets and they're rioting and jumping up and down, pawing the ground, biting the bushes and throwing bricks through the bank's windows. Well, okay, you can do that. It isn't going to change anything. It isn't going to help you. It'll get you thrown in jail, and it'll do this, that, and another thing. Government will respond with their usual printing more money or changing the color. In our country, we got green money. We'll change the color to blue or something else, something pretty. And then the government will make edicts and make declarations like they did back in 1783 and 1760 and so on to compel people to use this worthless paper. Now, I don't know how bad the riots in the street are going to get, or the revolution, or whatever. But for the wise at heart, that'll be the time for you to pull in your horns and stay home, stay off the streets. Don't get involved with the mobs. Let them go out and vent their rage. But in the meantime, you need to have something on hand. Let me give you a little tip here. When the banks close, they may close for as long as 6 weeks. That's a long time, 6 weeks. So if you've got gold and you're going to convert your gold into the hyperinflated money and then go down to Walmart and buy the goods, let's wake up here. First of all, you have to have a gold broker to take your gold to, don't you? And your gold broker, he's the guy that has the account at the bank, and he's going to take your gold and he's going to give you this paper, right? That's the way it works today. See, if I need to go to Walmart, I got to take a piece of gold into the gold broker, put it on the counter, and he gives me barter papers from the Federal Reserve that I take down to Walmart. Now, here's what the reality of it is. If the banks close with a bank holiday, they'll be closed for at least the weekend, possibly 1 week, could extend to 2 weeks. In a real crisis, 3 weeks. And if there's anarchy, it could be 4, 5, or 6 weeks. That means, boys and girls, you don't have any money for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 weeks. What are you going to do to solve that problem? Okay, watch this. You know these clad quarters that you're getting? You know, this worthless money? Well, you stockpile some of that up. Now, maybe in your business or maybe in your household, you might need $4,000 or $5,000 worth of these clad quarters. Maybe you need $10,000 worth to tide you over for and plan on 6 weeks. If it lasts a week, well, great. Now, the downside of this is that every day that goes by, if you have $1,000 worth of clad quarters saved up, you're losing $70 right now, 7%, $70 worth of purchasing power every year. But $1,000 right now in clad quarters, it costs me $100 to fill up the tank of my car. That would give me 10 tankfuls of gasoline, wouldn't it? That would buy something at the Walmart store, or it would buy something from my neighbor, wouldn't it? I could pay him in clad quarters while they're making this money transition. You put that on the shelf, and the ultimate end, it will be inflated away to nothing, but in a crisis, you've got something tangible. I don't like the paper because the paper is what they're going to change, but they don't change the coin. See, there's too much of it out there, and they can't change it. Furthermore, it's in lower denominations, and most people don't have that much of it. You know, you probably got $100 or $200 worth of coin. That's good. Why don't you concentrate on getting $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, whatever it is you think you're going to need for 6 weeks, and that will be your emergency money. All right. Because your broker isn't going to be able to trade your gold in for a while. And then trying to educate people to take gold and silver, you know, it works a little bit here and a little bit there. But it's not nearly as good as whatever the paper these people are used to. The masses of people are used to paper. That's what they want. They want worthless paper. Let's give it to them. So the printing presses were running. Now, in the history of the modern world pointed out that the only ones destroyed now, remember, those on fixed incomes. Tax revenue was quickly devalued by the government's own rapid inflation, which further induced the government to rely almost solely on inflation to pay for the government's expenditures. So in 1923 and 24, Germans just quit paying taxes. And that's because it costs more to collect the taxes, and the money is going to depreciate so rapidly that we might as well just print it. And that's where this thing is headed. So the government, you won't need to worry about paying your taxes until they change the color. Tax rates couldn't be changed except once a year, so that source of revenue quickly became irrelevant. Notice that had the government not been able to directly pay so much money into the hands of a majority of its citizens, the inflation spiral would have been limited. Price inflation cannot continue unless a large percentage of people have automatically increasing amounts of cash to pay for the rising prices. If the majority does not, buying slows down dramatically with rising prices, and that forces prices to fall in order to attract more buyers. Well, I would contend that the government has available at least 100 million people directly to put money into their hands. 10% of the workforce works for the government, and you have 50 million people on Social Security. You've got teachers, firemen, you've got all these government employees, and the government employees, whether they're at the state level or the federal level, will all be getting money right off the printing presses. I think they've got the infrastructure in place to do that. Plus, they'll be able to pour money into the defense contractors, which then will be passed on to their employees, which then will go out and bid prices up. And then when the stores and the merchants get a hold of the money, then they'll go out and spend it, and the velocity of money will accelerate dramatically. And as I pointed out earlier, once the process kicks in Brazil, 5 days is all it took. 5 days, that's 1 week. All right. Now, there was another factor, the relative size of the monetary base before the inflation. You know, Germany was a moderate-sized nation, and they had a large economy compared to most other European countries. Nevertheless, the German mark was not used around the world as an international currency. The British pound was the major world currency at that time. So it was not particularly difficult to double the money supply in Germany in 1 year and then quadruple it the next. In a 4-year period, the German mark went from 14 marks to the dollar to a trillion marks to the dollar. Now, you can't do that with the dollar today. The dollar has spread out so much around the world as an international currency that there are at least 200 trillion printed dollars outstanding. Now, there's that number again. 200. Now, I didn't exaggerate that now. That's what he's got here. 200 trillion printed dollars outstanding. Now, those dollars are sitting out there somewhere in people's hands, and probably 800 trillion in contracts that have never been monetized. That's a staggering amount. That's called one quadrillion. Boys and girls, there's more than enough money out there to cause hyperinflation. We just don't know what the trigger is going to be. What is going to trigger that? All right, now remember these newsletters now. This is the World Affairs Brief by Joel Skousen. You want The Privateer. You want TheMoneyChanger.com. And you want The International Forecaster. That's Bob Chapman. TheInternationalForecaster.com. There's four for you. Now, tomorrow night we'll close this out, and I'll give you a report from the Reagan administration that told us what was coming 25 years ago. And we didn't listen then. I doubt if we're going to listen now, but maybe a few of you will, and that'll be of great advantage to you. All right, I'm out of time here, boys and girls. Let's wrap it up by reminding you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. That's it. I got to leave it right there. Remind you that we'll see you tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.